The girls came down and we started out on our big night, once more pushing the car down the street. "Whee-oh! Let's go!" cried Dean, and we jumped in the back seat and clanked to the Little Harlem on Folsom Street. Out we jumped in the warm, mad night, hearing a wild tenor man bawling horn across the way, going, "Ee-ah! Ee-ah! Ee-ah!" and hands clapping to the beat and folks yelling, "Go! Go! Go!" Dean was already racing across the street with his thumb in the air, yelling, "Blow, man, blow!" A bunch of colored men in Saturday night suits were whooping it up in front. It was a sawdust saloon with a small bandstand on which the fellows huddled with their hats on, blowing over people's heads. A crazy place. Crazy, floppy women wandered around, sometimes in their bathrobes. Bottles clanked in the alley. In back of the joint, in a dark corridor beyond the splattered toilets, scores of men and women stood against the wall, drinking wine spodiote and spitting at the stars, wine and whiskey. The behatted tenorman was blowing at the peak of a wonderfully satisfactory free idea, a rising and falling riff that went from ee-yah to a crazier ee-dee-lee-yah, and blasted along to the rolling crash of butt-scarred drums hammered by a big, brutal Negro with a bull neck who didn't give a damn about anything but punishing his busted tubs. Crash, rattle, tee-boom, crash. Uproars of music, and the tenorman had it, and everybody knew he had it. Dean was clutching his head in the crowd, and it was a mad crowd. They were all urging that tenorman to hold it and keep it with cries and wild eyes, and he was raising himself from a crouch and going down again with his horn, looping it up in a clear cry above the Führer. A six-foot skinny Negro woman was rolling her bones at the man's hornbell, and he just jabbed it at her. Ee, ee, ee! Everybody was rocking and roaring. Galetta and Marie, with beer in their hands, were standing on their chairs, shaking and jumping. Groups of colored guys stumbled in from the street, falling over one another to get there. "Stay with it, man," roared a man with a foghorn voice, and let out a big groan that must have been heard clear out in Sacramento. "Aha! Woo!" said Dean. He was rubbing his chest, his belly. The sweat splashed from his face. Boom, kick, that drummer was kicking his drums down the cellar and rolling the beat upstairs with his murderous sticks, rattly boom. A big fat man was jumping on the platform, making it sag and creak. Phew! The pianist was only pounding the keys with spread eagle fingers, chords at intervals when the great tenorman was drawing breath for another blast. Chinese chords, shuddering the piano in every timbre, chink and wire, boing. The tenorman jumped down from the platform and stood in the crowd, blowing around. His hat was over his eyes. Somebody pushed it back for him. He just hauled back and stamped his foot and blew down a hoarse, bawling blast and drew breath and raised the horn and blew high, wide, and screaming in the air. Dean was directly in front of him with his face lowered to the bell of the horn, clapping his hands, pouring sweat on the man's keys, and the man noticed and laughed in his horn, a long, quivering, crazy laugh. And everybody else laughed, and they rocked and rocked. And finally the tenorman decided to blow his top and crouched down and held a high note in high C for a long time, as everything else crashed along and the cries increased, and I thought the cops would come swarming from the nearest precinct. Dean was in a trance. The tenorman's eyes were fixed straight on him. He had a madman who not only understood, but cared and wanted to understand more and much more than there was, and he began dueling for this. Everything came out of the horn. No more phrases, just cries, cries, baw, and down to beep, and up to ee, and down to clinkers and over to sideways echoing horn sounds. He tried everything, up, down, sideways, upside down, horizontal, 30 degrees, 40 degrees, and finally he fell back in somebody's arms and gave up, and everybody pushed around and yelled, "Yes, yes, he blowed that one." Dean wiped himself with his handkerchief. Then up stepped the tenorman on the bandstand and asked for a slow beat. and looked sadly out the open door over people's heads and began singing, "Close Your Eyes." Things quieted down a minute. The tenorman wore a tattered suede jacket, a purple shirt, cracked shoes, and zoot pants without press. He didn't care. He looked like a Negro Hassel. His big brown eyes were concerned with sadness and the singing of songs slowly and with long, thoughtful pauses. But in the second chorus he got excited and grabbed the mic and jumped down from the bandstand and bent to it. To sing a note he had to touch his shoe tops and pull it all up to blow, and he blew so much he staggered from the effect and only recovered himself in time for the next long, slow note. "Music play." He leaned back with his face to the ceiling mic held below. He shook, he swayed, then he leaned in, almost falling with his face against the mic. "Make it dreamy for dancing." And he looked at the street outside with his lips curled in scorn. Billie Holiday's hip sneer. "While we go romancing," he staggered sideways, "love's holiday." He shook his head with disgust and weariness at the whole world. "We'll make it seem..." What would it make it seem? Everybody waited. He mourned. "Okay." The piano hit a chord. "So baby, come on, just close your pretty little eyes." His mouth quivered. He looked at us, Dean and me, with an expression that seemed to say, "Hey now, what's this thing we're all doing in this sad brown world?" And then he came to the end of his song, and for this there had to be an elaborate preparations, during which time you could send all the messages to Garcia around the world 12 times, and what difference did it make to anybody? Because here we were dealing with the pit and prune juice of poor beat life itself in the god-awful streets of man. So he said it and sang it. "Close your..." and blew it way up to the ceiling and through to the stars and on out. "Eyes." And staggered off the platform to brood. He sat in the corner with a bunch of boys and paid no attention to them. He looked down and wept. He was the greatest. Dean and I went over to talk to him. We invited him out to the car. In the car, he suddenly yelled, "Yes! Ain't nothing I like better than good kicks! Where do we go?" Dean jumped up and down in the seat, giggling maniacally. "Later, later," said the tenorman. "I'll get my boy to drive us down to Jameson's Nook. I got to sing. Man, I live to sing. Been singing Close Your Eyes for 2 weeks. I don't want to sing nothing else. What are you boys up to?" We told him we were going to New York in 2 days. "Lord, I ain't never been there, and they tell me it's a real jumping town. But I ain't got no cause complaining where I am. I'm married, you know." "Oh, yes?" said Dean, lighting up. "And where is the darling tonight?" "What do you mean?" said the tenor man, looking at him out of the corner of his eye. "I told you I was married to her, didn't I?" oh, yes," said Dean. "I was just asking. Maybe she has friends, or sisters. A ball, you know. I'm just looking for a ball." "Yeah, what good's a ball? Life's too sad to be bawling all the time," said the tenor man, lowering his eye to the street. "Shit," he said, "I ain't got no money and I don't care tonight." We went back in for more. The girls were so disgusted with Dean and me for gunning off and jumping around that they had left and gone to Jameson's Nook on foot. The car wouldn't run anyway. We saw a horrible sight in the bar. A white hipster fairy had come in wearing a Hawaiian shirt and was asking the big drummer if he could sit in. The musicians looked at him suspiciously. "Do you blow?" He said he did, mincing. They looked at one another and said, "Yeah, yeah, that's what the man does. Shit." So the fairy sat down at the tubs, and they started the beat of a jump number, and he began stroking the snares with soft, goofy bop brushes, swaying his neck with that complacent, rice-analyzed ecstasy that doesn't mean anything except too much tea and soft foods and goofy kicks on the cool order. But he didn't care. He smiled joyously into space and kept the beat, though softly, with bop subtleties, a giggling, rippling background for big, solid foghorn blues the boys were blowing, unaware of him. The big Negro bull-necked drummer sat waiting for his turn. "What that man doing?" he said. "Play the music," he said. "What in hell?" he said. "Shee!" and looked away, disgusted. The tenorman's boy showed up. He was a little taut Negro with a great big Cadillac. We all jumped in. He hunched over the wheel and blew the car clear across Frisco without stopping once. 70 miles an hour, right through traffic, and nobody even noticed him. He was so good. Dean was in ecstasies. "Dig this guy, man. Dig the way he sits there and don't move a bone and just balls that jack and can talk all night while he's doing it. Only thing is, he doesn't bother with talking. Ah, man, the things I could, ah, wish. Oh, yes. Let's go. Let's not stop. Go now. Yes." And the boy wound around the corner and bowled us right in front of Jameson's Nook and was parked. A cab pulled up. Out of it jumped a skinny, withered little Negro preacher man who threw a dollar at the cabbie and yelled, "Blow!" and ran into the club and dashed right through the downstairs bar yelling, "Blow! Blow! Blow!" and stumbled upstairs, almost falling on his face, and blew the door open and fell into the jazz session room with his hands out to support him against anything he might fall on. And he fell right on Lampshade, who was working as a waiter in Jameson's Nook that season. And the music was there, blasting and blasting, and he stood transfixed in the open door, screaming, "Blow for me, man, blow!" And the man was a little short Negro with an alto horn that Dean said obviously lived with his grandmother, just like Tom Snark. Slept all day and blew all night and blew 100 choruses before he was ready to jump for fair, and that's what he was doing. "It's Carlo Marx!" screamed Dean above the fury. And it was. This little grandmother's boy with the taped-up alto and beady, glittering eyes, small, crooked feet, spindly legs, and he hopped and flopped with his horn and threw his feet around and kept his eyes fixed on the audience, which was just people laughing at a dozen tables, the room 30 by 30 feet and low ceiling. And he never stopped. He was very simple in his ideas. What he liked was the surprise of a new simple variation of a chorus. He'd go from tap-tap-tatterata, tap-tap-tatterata, repeating and hopping to it and kissing and smiling into his horn to tup e da dee de rup ta tup e da dee de rup. And it was all great moments of laughter and understanding for him and everyone else who heard. His tone was clear as a bell, high, pure, and blew straight in our faces from 2 feet away. Dean stood in front of him, oblivious to everything else in the world, with his head bowed, his hands socking in together, his whole body jumping on his heels in the sweat, always the sweat, pouring and splashing down his tormented collar to lie actually in a pool at his feet. Galeta and Maria were there, and it took us 5 minutes to realize it. Whew! Frisco nights, the end of the continent and the end of doubt. All dull doubt and tomfoolery, goodbye. Lampshade was roaring around with his trays of beer. Everything he did was in rhythm. He yelled at the waiters with the beat, "Hey now, baby, baby, make away, it's Lampshade coming your way." And he hurled by her with the beers in the air and roared through the swinging doors into the kitchen and danced with the cooks and came sweating back. The horn man sat absolutely motionless at a corner table with an untouched drink in front of him, staring gook-eyed into space, his hands hanging at his side till they almost touched the floor, his feet outspread like lolling tongues, his body shriveled into absolute weariness and entranced sorrow and what all was on his mind. A man who knocked himself out every evening and let the others put the quietest to him in the night. Everything swirled around him like a cloud. and that little grandmother's alto, that little Carlo Marx, hopped and monkey danced with his magic horn and blew 200 choruses of blues, each one more frantic than the other, and no signs of failing energy or willingness to call anything a day. The whole room shivered. On the corner of 4th and Folsom, an hour later, I stood with Ed Fournier, a San Francisco alto man who waited with me while Dean made a phone call in a saloon to have Roy Johnson pick us up. It wasn't anything much. We were just talking, except that suddenly we saw a very strange and insane sight. It was Dean. He wanted to give Roy Johnson the address of the bar, so he told him to hold the phone a minute and ran out to sea, and to do this he had to rush pell-mell through a long bar of brawling drinkers in white shirt sleeves, go to the middle of the street and look at the post signs. He did this, crouched low to the ground like Groucho Marx, his feet carrying him with amazing swiftness out of the bar like an apparition, with his balloon thumb stuck up in the night, and came to a whirling stop in the middle of the road, looking everywhere above him for the signs. They were hard to see in the dark, and he spun a dozen times in the road, thumb upheld in a wild, anxious silence. A wild-haired person with a ballooning thumb held up like a great goose of the sky, spinning and spinning in the dark, the other hand distractedly inside his pants. Ed Fournier was saying, "I blow a sweet tone wherever I go, and if people don't like it, it ain't nothing I can do about it. Say, man, that buddy of yours is a crazy cat. Look at him over there." And we looked. There was a big silence everywhere as Dean saw the signs and rushed back in the bar, practically going under someone's legs as they came out, and gliding so fast through the bar that everybody had to do a double take to see him. A moment later, Roy Johnson showed up, and with the same amazing swiftness, Dean glided across the street and into the car without a sound. We were off again. "Now, Roy, I know you're all hung up with your wife about this thing, but we absolutely must make 46th and Geary in the incredible time of 3 minutes, or everything is lost." "Yes." "In the morning, Sal and I are leaving for New York, and this is absolutely our last night of kicks, and I know you won't mind." No, Roy Johnson didn't mind. He only drove through every red light he could find and hurried us along in our foolishness. At dawn, he went home to bed. Dean and I had ended up with a colored guy named Walter who ordered drinks at the bar and had them lined up and said, "Wine spodioti," which was a shot of port wine, a shot of whiskey, and a shot of port wine. "Nice sweet jacket for all that bad whiskey," he yelled. He invited us to his home for a bottle of beer. He lived in the tenements in back of Howard. His wife was asleep when we came in. The only light in the apartment was the bulb over her head. We had to get up on a chair and unscrew the bulb as she lay smiling there. Dean did it, fluttering his lashes. She was about 15 years older than Walter and the sweetest woman in the world. Then we had to plug in the extension over her bed, and she smiled and smiled. She never asked Walter where he had been, what time it was, nothing. Finally, we were set in the kitchen with the extension and sat down around the humble table to drink the beer and tell the stories. Dawn. It was time to leave and move the extension back to the bedroom and screw back the bulb. Walter's wife smiled and smiled as we repeated the insane thing all over again. She never said a word. Out on the Dawn street, Dean said, "Now you see, man, there's real woman for you. Never a harsh word, never a complaint or modified. Her old man can come home in any hour of the night without anybody and have talks in the kitchen and drink the beer and leave any old time. This is a man, and that's his castle." He pointed up at the tenement. We stumbled off. The big night was over. A cruising car followed us suspiciously for a few blocks. We bought fresh donuts in a bakery on 3rd Street and ate them in the gray, ragged street. A tall, bespectacled, well-dressed fellow came stumbling down the street with a Negro in a truck-driving cap. They were a strange pair. A big truck rolled by, and the Negro pointed at it excitedly and tried to express his feeling. The tall white man furtively looked over his shoulder and counted his money. "It's old Bull Lee," giggled Dean, "counting his money and worried about everything, and all that other boy wants to do is talk about trucks and things he knows." We followed them a while. Holy flowers floating in the air, were all these tired faces in the dawn of Jazz America. We had to sleep. Galetta Dunkel's was out of the question. Dean knew a railroad brakeman called Ernest Burke who lived with his father in a hotel room on 3rd Street. Originally he'd been on good terms with him, but lately not so, and the idea was for me to try persuading them to let us sleep on their floor. It was horrible. I had to call from a morning diner. The old man answered the phone suspiciously. He remembered me from what his son had told him. To our surprise, he came down to the lobby and let us in. It was just a sad old brown Frisco hotel. We went upstairs, and the old man was kind enough to give us the entire bed. "I have to get up anyway," he said, and retired to the little kitchenette to brew coffee. He began telling stories about his railroading days. He reminded me of my father. I stayed up and listened to the stories. Dean, not listening, was washing his teeth and bustling around and saying, "Yes, that's right," to everything he said. Finally, we slept, and in the morning Ernest came back from a Western Division run and took the bed as Dean and I got up. Now old Mr. Burke dolled himself up for a date with his middle-aged sweetheart. He put on a green tweed suit, a cloth cap, also green tweed, and stuck a flower in his lapel. These romantic old broken-down Frisco brakemen live sad but eager lives of their own, I told Dean in the toilet. It was very kind of him to let us sleep here. "Yes, yes," said Dean, not listening. He rushed out to get a travel bureau car. My job was to hurry to Galetta Dunkel's for our bags. She was sitting on the floor with her fortune-telling cards. "Well, goodbye, Galetta, and I hope everything works out fine. When Ed gets back, I'm going to take him to Jameson's Nook every night and let him get his fill of madness. Do you think that'll work, Sal? I don't know what to do." "What do the cards say?" "The Ace of Spades is far away from him. The Heart cards always surround him. The Queen of Hearts is never far. See this Jack of Spades? That's Dean. He's always around. Well, we're leaving for New York in an hour. Some day Dean's going to go on one of these trips and never come back." She let me take a shower and shave, and then I said goodbye and took the bags downstairs and hailed a Frisco taxi jitney, which was an ordinary taxi that ran a regular route, and you could hail it from any corner and ride to any quarter you want for about 15 cents, cramped in with the other passengers like on a bus, but talking and telling jokes like in a private car. Mission Street that last day in Frisco was a great riot of construction work, children playing, whooping Negroes coming home from work, dust, excitement, the great buzzing and vibrating hum of what is really America's most excited city, and overhead the pure blue sky and the joy of the foggy sea that always rolls in at night to make everybody hungry for food and further excitement. I hated to leave. My stay had lasted 60-odd hours. With frantic Dean, I was rushing through the world without a chance to see it. In the afternoon, we were buzzing towards Sacramento and eastward again.